Welcome back, everyone, to the front line with Joe and Joe. Joe Pasillo and Joe Resinello.
Oh, you're exactly right, Joe.
We work for the man upstairs, as you do.
You're setting me up quite well. You just gave me an alley-oop.
The greatest revolutionary act you can commit right now is to open your mouth and speak the truth.
Whether you're an academic or you're a regular guy, we have to be fearless.
And once more, dear brothers and sisters, let us go into the breach. Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the front line with Joe and Joe. Joe Pasillo, as always, joined by Joe Resinello. And once more, dear brothers and sisters, let us go into the breach on the Veritas Catholic Radio Network, 1350 on your AM dial, 103.9 on your FM dial, spreading the truth of the Catholic faith in the New York City metropolitan area. Please be sure to download the app, the Veritas app. Share it with your friends. You'll have access to all of our station's content. If you like what Joe and I do, we're all over social media, Rumble, Twitter, YouTube, Facebook. Please, wherever you see us, like, subscribe, share, do all that fun stuff. Today, we have a very interesting conversation. Joe, I like to think all of our conversations are interesting, but sometimes we get an author and a topic that I myself say, wow, this is going to be really fun. Gil Bailey, he wrote a new book, The Apocalypse of the Sovereign Self: Recovering the Christian Mystery of Personhood. And that's correct me if I'm wrong, Gil, that's available at Angelico Press. Am I correct?
Sure. And anywhere books are sold.
Okay, absolutely. And we always encourage our audience to go out there and support our Catholic publishers. And if you have to, go ahead, go buy it from you know who, Mr. Yeah. Bezos. But in the meantime, if you could support our Catholic publishers, that'd
absolutely be
great. Absolutely. So Gil Bailey is the founder of the Cornerstone Forum, a founding member of the Colloquium on Violence and Religion, a member of the Fellowship of Catholic Scholars, and the College of Fellows of the Dominican School of Philosophy and Theology. Gil Bailey, welcome to the front line with Joe and Joe, our brother.
Thank you. So nice to be with you.
It's our pleasure. So with that, we'll hand it over to Joe, and we're going to have a great conversation.
Yeah, we always start with a prayer to Our Lady. In the name of the Father, Son, Holy Spirit, amen. Remember, O most gracious Virgin Mary, never was it known that anyone who sought your help or sought your intercession was left unaided. Inspired by this confidence, we fly unto you, a virgin of virgins, our mother. To you we come, for you we stand, sinful and sorrowful. O mother of the word incarnate, despise not our petitions, but in your clemency hear and answer us, amen. In the name of the Father, Son, Holy Spirit, amen. Well, Gil, I'll be honest. Like, we get a lot of requests to come on the show from various publishers. The title of your book jumped out at Joe and I immediately. No lie. I think it's interesting. The Apocalypse of the Sovereign Self. And then you have the subtitle, Recovering the Christian Mystery of Personhood. How do they both relate to each other? How'd you come up with the title?
Well, the apocalypse means revelation, the revelation of the situation, but it also has
apocalyptic implications in the popular sense of the term. The sovereign self, the word sovereign is important here. The word self and the word person are not synonyms. In some way, they're antonyms. In some way, they're antagonistic to each other. A person is always someone who has a responsibility to another and who lives and flourishes in connection with that responsibility. A self in the sovereign self is a self that simply tries to fulfill itself without reference to obligations and to any suffering that might be required by virtue of those obligations. So it's, even though people use the terms as though they're synonyms, they're quite different. And I have a way of showing the difference between the self and the person, if you'll permit me. I have two quotations that...
Gil, if you don't mind, just could you speak just a little bit more directly into the microphone? I apologize.
Okay, well, the microphone is in my hearing aid.
That's much better.
That's cool.
That's much better.
I'll speak up anyway. So there are two quotations that I think set this frame it reasonably well. The sovereign self can be summarized in one sentence from Justice Anthony Kennedy's 1992 Supreme Court decision, Casey decision, and in which he said the following: at the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. In other words, the self can simply make it up and decide what's real and what's not real. And that, and this, we see this everywhere today, so that it is not under an obligation, a solemn obligation to another. It's simply the absurd attempt to try to self-fulfill without reference to a network of obligations, transcendent ones and collateral ones. And this is the most obvious nonsense of that is in the transcendent thing, where it's if you wake up one morning and you think you're the opposite sex, then that's all that's required for that to become real.
Gil, I'm a giraffe, by the way, just so you know. I woke up today. That was I identify as a giraffe.
There you have it. But that's been solemnly proclaimed by the United States Supreme Court. And it, of course, it's not true and never will be true. And it won't last. If our nation lasts, that decision will not last. It's absolutely absurd. Now, to go to the question of the person, I want to quote from Romano Guardini, who's one of the great theologians of the 20th century, German theologian. He said, and I quote this in the book, "The knowledge of what it means to be a person is inextricably bound up with the faith of Christianity. An affirmation and cultivation of the personal can endure for a time, perhaps, after faith has been extinguished, but gradually they too will be lost. Christianity has brought the mystery of personhood into focus for us. And what is that mystery? That mystery is I have a role to play in a drama, which is the Christian drama. The drama of the revelation of truth. And that role, however modest it might be, is what provides dignity and what gives real satisfaction in a person's life. To be under obligation is to be free in a way that superficial freedom has no concept of."
I agree with you 100%, 100%, but there requires to accept that a humility. You see, that's what's pride is the driving sin of man, always was. It's pride is within the church as well. People want to do things the way they want to do it. They're not like, I look at it this way. I come from a simple stock, and I think of it this way. There's two approaches to living as a child of God. You're either clay, as in the old saying, I am the potter and you are the clay. And what does a potter do? He molds you. You're not in the shape you're supposed to be yet, but clay is easily molded, which requires humility. It's acknowledging that you are going to shape me. Or you could be marble. And then what does God have to do? He has to use a hammer and a chisel, and it's violent. And that is the life of man. We've chose the latter. And God, who loves both people and wants both of them in heaven, uses the hammer and chisel. And it's a violent action to get people's attention, because God knows logic, reason, and facts don't. I've tried that. Gil, for a long time, and no one's listening to me. But I'll tell you this, God gets their attention that way. But again, talk about the humility required to acknowledge what you're saying, because a person who thinks they know everything, they're not going to listen. They need the hammer and the chisel, and God provides it.
That's a wonderful way of speaking of this problem. The idea that to be under obligation is a constraint on our experience is a terrible mistake. You ask any parent of small children of whether having the obligations to take care of these children and to try to give them a proper formation, and those obligations are sometimes quite onerous. What would a parent say about that? They would say that obligation is what made me an adult. And so the idea that we have to free ourselves from obligations in order to be free. And freedom is a myth, is a paradox. It's a paradox. So the person is someone under obligation. We are undergoing now a civilizational crisis, as I'm sure you both know. It's very profound, and there's no guarantee we're going to, pull out of it. But I trust we have the resources to pull out of it. If we return, this civilizational crisis is essentially the de-Christianization of our culture.
Gil, you mentioned, Gil, real quick, Gil Bailey's joining us here at the Frontline with Joe and Joe. Joe Pasillo, Joe Resinello, we're way in the breach. Gil's written a new book. It's available at Angelico Press, The Apocalypse of the Sovereign Self, Recovering the Christian Mystery of Personhood. Gil, I want to stay there for one second, okay? A constant theme at the Frontline with Joe and Joe is exactly what you're saying. I want you to expand on it a little bit more, okay? The civilizational crisis that we're in is that those who would sell you freedom are your slave masters. And the slave masters convince you that the one who truly frees you, which is Jesus Christ and his church, are your slave masters. To Joe and myself, there is the crux of your civilizational crisis. And again, it speaks to your book. Who am I as a person? Am I unmoored from everything? Like Anthony Kennedy says, I actually can define the universe. The hubris and the pride in that statement is beyond so incomprehensible.
He did go to Stanford, Joe. He did go to Stanford. Anthony.
He did go to Stanford, but it's a ridiculous statement. It's my point that guys like us who don't have PhDs can understand, but that's why we have Gil here. Gil, I want because we constantly tell our audience to beware of those who sell you freedom. Those are the ones who are seeking to destroy society, to enslave everyone. And the only one who could free you is Jesus Christ, because he's the only one who actually respects you as a person. Please speak to that, Gil.
Well, yeah, we use the word freedom, to the extent that freedom is license, it's a recipe for enslavement, because you never get enough of what you really don't want. And so you're constantly trying to, establish yourself as independent, as autonomous, and so on and so forth. It doesn't work. That's not how we're made. We're in many ways, it's an anthropological crisis, which means we have forgotten what defines our species. Our species, alone among all the species on this planet, is religious. We are religious creatures, and we will invest our religious longing. This is what distinguishes human beings: religious longing. And the question is, what are we going to do with it? And there are so many ways of investing it in things that are totally unworthy of it. And as soon as we become a secularized civilization, there's no longer any invitation to transfer that religious longing to what is worthy of it. And so what the result of that is ideologies. Ideologies are secular religions, and they're full of passion. They're full of animosity, and they're made up by and large of unhappy people who try to avoid their unhappiness by foisting their theology on everybody else.
Gil, didn't Yeats write about that in The Second Coming when he said the worst are full of passionate intensity?
Of course. Yeah, exactly right.
You know, and which leads you to a quick question. You dedicate several chapters in the book to the work of such figures like Descartes, Rousseau, Eliot, Nietzsche, and others. I want to throw something out there to you. I've mentioned this before on the show. One of the more frightening lines in The Wasteland is when Eliot writes, "I will show you fear in a handful of dust." And the way I always took that was, because the whole theme, obviously, of The Wasteland is the crumbling cities, the crumbling of civilization, okay? And I always saw the character that he's speaking to, the persona, holding up a handful of dust, and that's the crumbling cities. There's your crumbling Western civilization, which is moored in Christian principles, all right? Which is now reduced to a handful of dust. And he says, that's something you should fear. Talk about that, because I don't think people fear it enough, Gil. I think if people understood exactly what that means, what their goal is, which is the destruction of Western civilization, of Christian civilization, then you better run for the hills, because then you're in a really dark place. I'd love your comments on that, Gil. Or tell me if you even agree with me.
Well, I do agree with you, but I know that you agree with me when I say running for the hills is not one of the options.
Yeah, no, I'm with you on that.
So what has to happen? We have to. Our civilization has a Christian foundation. Without that foundation, it falls apart. And to the extent that we have de-Christianizing our civilization, we are producing pathologies that have become, just in the last few years, have become so grotesque and so obvious that every sane person has to realize that we're in a crisis. And the crisis is not only the de-Christianization, but another part of the same thing, which is that we have lost the realization that we are religious creatures. Dogs and cats are not religious. You know, giraffes are not religious.
Today I'm a giraffe.
but we are, and we can deny it. But when we deny it, we turn something into a religion. And increasingly, what the manufactured religions that are going on in a post-Christian world, which we hope will be, Christianity will be revived, but what goes on in a post-Christian world is manufactured religions that go by the name of ideology. Mm-hmm. And they spring up and they bloom and they die, and they spring up and they bloom and they die, but they do huge amount of damage because they attract the religious longing of people, that it is our obligation to reorient properly to our Lord. This is what made Western civilization what it is. And so we're in a civilizational crisis, and at the heart of it is the understanding of what it means to be a person in the full Christian sense. You know, the word person came into Western vocabulary when Tertullian, and I quote him on the back of the book, famous thing, the soul is naturally Christian. But before that, he made the word person he brought the word person into Christian vocabulary by defining the Trinity as three persons in one God. Nobody had ever, that was an absolutely original formulation, and it stood the test of time. Those persons, the Trinitarian persons, do not exist independently. They do not, they are in relationship. God himself is in relationship.
And you know, I'm glad you brought up the quote by Tertullian. I was actually going to bring that up because when I read that, it reminded me of the Baltimore Catechism, the first line, that we are created by God to love him, to serve him, and be with him in, for all eternity. And what you're talking about, and this is, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think you're going to disagree, there's a commonality between all men, whether you are walking in the jungles in Paraguay, or you're on Madison Avenue in Manhattan. And that commonality is that you were created by God. And we have lost that identity. And when somebody loses that, something breaks inside of them. Because God has a natural longing for his creation. He loves you. And that's what the reaching is. We're reaching for that connection that has broken, it has severed. How do we bring that back? Now, we have shows like Joe and I, you know, we didn't go to the Gregorian, but we do know the faith. We talk to a lot of smart people like you. We try to bring ideas to people, and that's good. However, this is my understanding. People have to encounter radical Christianity. Radical. And that's what I'm trying to do personally. I'm going to be honest with you. I'm married to an African-American woman. That's not why I married her. I love her. I have five kids. They're all young. I live very modestly. I drive a 20-year-old car. I try to love my neighbor. I try to give outreach to the world. I'm praying. I want to be radically changed. So the world, outside of what I say, when they encounter me, they encounter Christ. And that is how we change the minds of the world. What I said, I think, is calculus, the way I look at it, but the world doesn't. They have to encounter. What's your thoughts?
I'm so impressed that you remember the Baltimore Catechism. I mean, if we could have a convention of all the people that remember the Baltimore Catechism. Is it still in print?
It should be.
It should be. I completely agree with you, of course. But what we have to do is I forget who said this. What we have to do is to show the world Christianity in such a way that they wish it was true, and then to show them that it is. If we live, we're part of Hans von Balthasar, great theologian of the 20th century, what he called the theodrama. We're all participants, actors in the theodrama. We are performing, to the extent that we are informed by our Christian faith, we realize that each of us has a role to play and that our roles are interwoven and mutually reinforcing, and that our task is simply to live as examples of what Christ can do to a person who's willing to be transformed. And the beauty, a Christian who's, all of us are sinners. So that goes without saying. And all of our attempts to live Christian lives, exemplary Christian lives, will be filled with egotism and all the funny business that goes along with being a fallen person. But to the extent that we can live with dignity and reverence, and always, in some subtle way at least, emanating the reality that we're not just nice people. Anything that others might find attractive in the way we live is we should go out of our way to help people realize that anything that others might feel that is interesting or attractive about the way we live is not due to our virtue. It's due to grace, which came to us or comes to us through our faith and our persistent attempt to exhibit that faith in our lives in as exemplary a way as we can. So the world is a missionary. We're missionaries in a world. This is one of the things that happens when we become increasingly de-Christianized.
That's a larger conversation, because I know you mentioned that Christians do not have careers, they have missions. I want to talk about what you just said for one second, though. You talked about like the sinfulness, and we have that. And I'll just share with you a personal like understanding of that. As hard as I try, and I do try, and so does my wife, I fall every day. What helps me realize something is when I go to confession, because it's humbling. Especially if you know the priest and like you're on the surface, you have this like life, like you march into church with your five kids. People are like, oh, you know, like as if like, you know, but look under the cover a little bit. I am far from perfect. But when you go to confession, God humbles you. And then he gives you grace. You talked about grace. When you truly encounter a holy person, and I have, I've encountered holy nuns in my life. I'm going to tell you right now, and I think this is the problem with when people point to the problems in the church, and I'm one of them sometimes, and I could get into that conversation. But when you meet somebody that's holy, I'm going to tell you right now, it's like a freight train. Like that person, yeah. And I have met people like that. I have actually almost come to tears just talking to some people like that. Like it's that like almost like affront to you. You're almost just like, Lord, this person is not human.
Let's leave it there, Joe, for one second. We got to take a break. Okay. So you're listening to us at the Front Line with Joe and Joe on the Veritas Catholic Radio Network. Gil Bailey is joining us. We're discussing his new book, The Apocalypse of the Sovereign Self, Recovering the Christian Mystery of Personhood. That's available at Angelico Press. Please support our Catholic publishers. You can buy it at other larger outlets if you need to. But we'd like for you to support Angelico in this case when you buy the book. So stick around. We have it. We're going to pick up on that right after the break. So stick around.
Catholic radio works. And now we have it here in Connecticut and New York. It's been seen around the country that there's no better tool for evangelization. Where there's Catholic radio, the folks who listen deepen their faith. Families are strengthened. Parishes and communities flourish. So, let people know you're listening to Veritas. Tell your friends to tune in. And let's make an impact here for Jesus and his church. This is Steve Lee for Veritas Catholic Network.
Welcome back, everyone, to The Front Line with Joe and Joe. Joe Pasillo and Joe Resinello, Way in the Breach with Gil Bailey. We're discussing his new book, The Apocalypse of the Sovereign Self, Recovering the Christian Mystery of Personhood. Joe Resinello, I know you had a question there for Gil.
Yeah, but I was talking about like holiness, and that comes from grace. You talked about that, Gil, on the other side of the break. People just think that's a term. No. That's real. God gives people grace. And when people open themselves up to it, empty themselves of self, and are filled with God's grace, they are transformed. And I'm going to tell you, if you gave me 12 people and this happened, we changed the whole world. We changed the world. One person. My father used to say that, God rest his soul. He was a simple person. He'd say, saints, one a century come along. That's all you need. Mm-hmm. One person. And there are more than one. What's your thoughts? Because people don't, they think I'm, you know, you say that, they're like, oh, you're crazy. You know, like, no, no, no. You meet Mother Teresa, meet Padre Pio, meet someone like that. It's like they stop traffic. What do you think? That's how we change the world, Gil.
No, I think that's absolutely true. Of course, that's the grace of God raising up a true saint like that. Each of us has the obligation to approximate that as much as we can. To go back to this idea of the theodrama, each of us has a role in it, and we may not be saints in that most lofty of senses, like Mother Teresa or so many others, but we can, in our own humble and flawed way, and communicate without necessarily doing it in words, but can communicate that if anyone finds anything admirable or laudable or interesting in our lives, if they come close enough to us, they should be able to recognize that it didn't come from some internal moral or spiritual superiority. It came from submission to a mission. Submission is to give oneself, to receive a mission from another, and that we are living under obligation. And that's what makes life rich and meaningful and profound. And it's the exact opposite of what people think about today in terms of the self, the freedom, the self that tries to satisfy its desire for freedom simply digs a deeper and deeper hole, because you never get enough of what you really don't want. And so I think we have an obligation. Now, in the book, what I tried to do, the first half of the book is about how we got into this predicament. And as you mentioned, I have chapters on, you know, Nietzsche and Dostoevsky and a lot of figures. And in these chapters, I'm not an academic. So I write as a layman. And I made these chapters interesting to an ordinary lay person. So you don't have to be an intellectual. But it gives us an idea that this problem we have today didn't start in the 1960s. It started, it depends on where you want to start, but it's been coming towards us for 200 or 300 years. But of course it picked up steam in the aftermath of World War I, World War II, these catastrophes. And so we have to recognize where we are in that drama. But our civilization is a Christian civilization. If it succeeds, if those people succeed who want to usher Christianity off the stage, if they were to succeed, our civilization would implode in a heartbeat. And unfortunately, we are precariously close to that. I don't think it's going to happen, because I believe in the grace of God. But each of us has an obligation, and the two of you are fulfilling that obligation. I'm not trying to just flatter my interviewer, but it appears to me that just from our conversation that the two of you are trying to fulfill that obligation in a remarkable way, and I congratulate you. And you have, and for somebody like me, I have to use the few little talents I have. They're not many, but I can write, and so I do that. And so this is, we're all part of this.
Well, Gil Bailey, let me ask you this. If you're just joining us here at the Veritas Catholic Radio Network, Gil Bailey's joining us, the Apocalypse of the Sovereign Self, Recovering the Christian Mystery of Personhood. Gil, I'm going to personalize this for a second, because I look at my life, I just had this thought, it is a microcosm of what you're talking about on a larger scale. You said we want more of the thing that we know that we don't want, which is funny. And I bring it up because I lived my life, 20 years of my life, okay, not practicing the faith. I never left the faith, but it really wasn't practicing. So you couldn't call me a Catholic in any meaningful sense of the word, okay? And I wanted more of those things I know that I didn't want. But here's the recognition where when as Paul said, when I was a child, I spoke as a child, but when I became a man, I put away childish things. What I do recognize, and I think this speaks to what you're talking about, I'd love for you to expand on this a little bit more, both in my personal life, but I would apply this to society. I'm just not, when we look at, let's say, when we become nostalgic for some prior time, this idyllic, let's say 1950s or prior to Vatican II or whatever the case might be, I will say this, my nostalgia relative to this conversation is for Logos, the recognition of Logos, of order. And when I the reason why I bring up my life is because I know my life now is not devoid of Logos, whereas before, to a very large degree, it was devoid of Logos. And I think in society, applying that to society, you mentioned, if you go back far enough, people were sinners, we're all sinners, we fall on a daily basis. But I think the difference is now we live in a nihilistic culture. You mentioned Nietzsche, okay? We live in an era of nihilism. What I'm nostalgic for is just a recognition of Logos. I'm not even asking, just on a societal level, Gil, and I want your comments. I'm not even asking for you necessarily to become a Catholic, even though I love for you to be convert. But if you don't recognize at least Logos, some order, both in your life, in your life of your family, in the life of your neighborhood, in the life of society, then we're going off that cliff that I think you're describing. So I would love for you to comment. That was a little long-winded way of saying, I'd love for you to comment on the difference between what we're living in now, which is nihilism, and maybe just a restoration of some semblance of Logos or order.
Yeah. Well, the nihilism is characterized by Herod's shrugging question, what is truth? You see, what is truth? That's pure nihilism. And this is the truth is whatever I say it is. So that abandons any sense of the Logos. Christ is the Logos. This is the amazing thing about Christianity. The Logos is not a set of doctrines, a set of principles. It's a person. You heard it here first. God is a genius. The genius is that when God wanted to give humanity the definitive instructions on how to fulfill the promise of personhood, all of us, as I repeat over and over and over again in the book, everyone is a person from the moment of conception. So it's not a question of, but the question is, will that promise of personhood be fulfilled in the life of the person? Or to what extent will that promise be fulfilled in the life of the person? So it goes back to the Logos. God, when God decided to provide the lasting, permanent instruction on how to live, he didn't create a new Ten Commandments. That was preliminary. So behave this way and behave that way and so on and so forth. But then came the decisive one. And the decisive instruction took the form of a human life. It was flesh. It was a person in history. So what is the ultimate truth? What is the formula for, or I shouldn't say formula, but what is the icon of what it means to fulfill the promise of personhood? It is a person. And what do we know about that person? He suffered. And he even suffered the severance of his most important relationship, which was with his heavenly Father, on the cross. My God, why have you abandoned me? He suffered. And so he showed us that suffering is part of it. And that this is what the self simply wants to avoid suffering. We Christians did not go looking for it. It'll come. And we'll get enough of it. But what we have to experience, not just know in our mind, what we have to experience, and this is hard for me. I had the same mixed background, you know. I went to Mass every day starting at the age of 15. And then my last year in law school, I walked away from church and didn't go back for 10 years. And that 10 years, I made a mess of my life. And so when I came back, I started going every day again. So it didn't trail off at either end. But so I learned my lesson. But Christ shows us that suffering is not only redemptive, but if it to acknowledge that there's always grace in the suffering. A self wants to avoid all suffering. All of us want to avoid suffering. We should. Nobody wants to go look for it, which would be false. But when it comes, we should experience it. We could be, as soon as we start, and I'm talking to myself here, as soon as we get into a situation where we're suffering, we should be on the lookout for grace.
No, Gil, listen, you're speaking our language, brother. Gil Bailey is joining us here at the front line with Joe and Joe. His new book, The Apocalypse of the Sovereign Self, Recovering the Christian Mystery of Personhood. Gil, I'm gonna hand it over to Joe. I will say this though, real quick about suffering. Two things. Number one, as you mentioned, the Theo drama. We understand suffering. We, like you said, we don't seek it out. It'll find you. We understand it. We can make sense of it, number one. And number two, when I argue with people when they make very stupid comments like God is indifferent to our suffering, my immediate retort is, I don't know if I mentioned to you, I'm a Roman Catholic. I'm a follower of Jesus Christ. Last time I checked, we believe he's God and we believe he suffered. So if you think God is indifferent to our suffering, you're talking about some other foreign God. I don't know who you're talking about. The Christian God is the God who suffers with us. That's what it means to have compassion, is he suffers with us. So we have to educate some of the atheists once in a while that they don't always know what they're talking about. Joe Resinello.
I want to talk about, you made a great point about Christ taking the form of a man, and he was fully human except in sin, and he suffered, but he also sacrificed. And I want to explore that. First point I want to make, and this is something that we kind of touched on already. Life does not make sense outside of Christ. It simply doesn't. And I think this is the confusion that we're seeing in many people, because Christ gives meaning to suffering. He gives meaning to sacrifice. These are things that are in every life, and he ultimately gives meaning to death. No religion does that. None. Zero. But Jesus also founded a church. He didn't found a book, as Joe Pasillo would say. He found a church. Why? And this is why I'm Catholic, because the sacraments give me grace. They are tools in my toolbox to be able to sacrifice. Why? Someone say, why would you want to live a life that is sacrificial? Because it's in dying to self that we find life, not only at the end, but here. You see, that's the paradox, but that's hard. You see, I've explained this to people like, you know, we could academically talk about what we're supposed to do. We could read or write a self-help book. There's many of them, self-help books outside of Christianity, telling people what to do. How do you execute that? Now, God gives us things. God willingly laid his life down for bad men, but he asks me to open my hand, pry open my hand, and give my life to my wife and my kids, and I resist it. I'm going to be honest. I resist it. My daughter threw up last night at 10 o'clock, and I did not want to get up. And when I did, I gave my other kids hell because they made her get sick because I was tired. And that's my daughter. She's two and she's cute as a button. And I still don't want to die to myself because I'm me. You see, that is where the church comes in. That's why we need it, because we are who we are. Talk about that, because that's another paradox, the sacrifice of self. You were a lawyer. I'm sure you ran in circles, people, you know, making bucks, living good lives, eating at nice restaurants. And you talk about, let's live a sacrificial life. They're like, whoa, 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 Gil, come on, come on. Me, I don't want to do that.
Well, first of all, and don't accuse me of being a lawyer. I graduated from law school, but I never took the bar, never practiced. I knew when I got out of law school, I didn't want to do that. So that's a long story.
Well, I work on Wall Street, Gil. Believe me, I'm no saint. I'm just telling. Right.
But I want to follow up on that just with a little anecdote that comes to me. When my son was maybe 6 years old or 7 years old, I was teaching court. I was traveling around to small towns around here, teaching courses at night, some of them at night and some of them. But anyway, I came in one night. Came in late. It was 11 o'clock or something. I finally got to bed, and my son threw up all over his bed in the middle of the night. And I was exhausted. And I got up, and I went into his room, and it was just a mess, you know. And I got him over here, and I started pulling off the sheets. And suddenly, I realized that there was no place on earth I would rather be than right there, right now. It was a revelation to me, because it wasn't because I was having, you know, nice thoughts. I was, you know, I didn't like the situation. But suddenly I realized he needs me, and I'm here. This is where I belong. And it's so liberating to realize that. And most of the time, even that's dramatic compared to what, you know, the kinds of obligations that we have, which are perhaps routine, and they're not even as graphic as that. But to the extent that we recognize that any suffering, we make up for what is lacking in the sufferings of Christ. And that ennobles our lives in ways that a non-Christian can't fathom.
I think that the way I'm looking at this, and I'm listening to you both, the way I see it and the thought that popped into my head was, you know, Springsteen had a song, The Ties That Bind. If you talk about the ties that bind, just because a mother has a daughter doesn't mean that there is a tie that binds there, because there are selfish mothers and fathers. OK, when you don't do what Joe's describing, and again, the difficulties of having to clean up puke at 10 o'clock at night, or you got to drive to a basketball after you worked all day and you got to take your kid to the basketball practice and sit there bored for an hour, okay, because you don't, the practices are not exciting, or anything like that. Even those small examples of daily sacrifice, those are the things that create those ties that bind, where you could not, and the reason why I'm saying this is because you mentioned that you're liberated by a Gil. I'm liberated from that life I described earlier, even though at the moment I feel discomfort. I don't want to say pain. All right. But if I'm exhausted, the only thing I'm thinking about is my pillow. But those little examples, those, they create the ties that bind, the real ties between a parent and their child, between a mother and a father, husband and a wife. That's what I think. That's where the grace comes in, because as both of you described, who are we apart from Christ? Nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing. And we have to go on the offensive with that message when it comes to bringing that aspect of the gospel out to the wider culture. We're nothing without Christ. Whether you're a Christian or not, you don't realize that without Logos and without God's grace, you're going to do nothing. You might think you're happy in the moment. Oh, I'm free. I'm free. There was a video the other day, a girl describing, she's 29 years old. She keeps saying over and over in the video, I don't have kids. That's why I could do this. I don't have kids. That's why I could do that. And all the comments were for people saying, you're an empty young lady. You have no life, while she's saying she has a life. A little long-winded rant there, Gil, but I'd love your comments on that. Creating the ties that bind, which are loving ties at the end of the day, require that sacrifice. And we can do that every day in all these small ways.
You know, you mentioned the young woman who is so proud of the fact that she doesn't have any obligations and she's free. One can only feel pity, but at the same time, you have to realize this: she didn't arrive at that idea on her own. It's pumped into her by the popular culture. It's a recipe for disappointment and sadness, and eventually rage. At some point, people become free and they slough off everything, and they're utterly free, they think, and unhappy, and it can be turned into rage, and rage can be turned into violence. And so you have a recipe for, an explosive situation. So again, we have to live in such a way that we make the Christian life, sinners though we are, we make the Christian life appealing. Again, to go back to that idea that we make people wish it was true, and then we show them that it is.
Absolutely. Gil, let me cut you off there because we only got about 4 minutes left. I want to hand it over to Joe for one final question for you.
Gil, you mentioned before, and I agree 100%, that we're heading towards a catastrophe. I've thought that for quite some time. We may even be closer to it than we realize. But you say we're not going to get there because you believe in Christ's kindness, his charity. You have that hope. Where do you see this going in your view? Because I looked, my reach is to Our Lady right now. Our Lady of Fatima, First Saturdays. I'm pushing that because I think America needs that. That's my thoughts. What are yours? Where's this going? And how does Christ reach a hand to us?
Well, in the short time we have, maybe I could say something about Hans-Urs von Balthasar, a great theologian I quoted earlier. He said that history consists of the mutual intensification of the yes and the no to Christ. History is history after the incarnation. Represents the mutual intensification of the yes and the no to Christ. That's the apocalypse, that mutual intensification. Our job is to make the Christian part of that more persuasive, more appealing than the rejection of Christ. And in case that seems like kind of crazy in some way, D.K. Chesterton, I'm going to paraphrase him. He said, if everybody lived 1,000 years, they would all die Catholic because they would have had enough experience to realize that what the church offers is the alternative to madness and sadness. So if we all lived to be 1,000 years old, We would look back on all that experience, and we would come to the conclusion that von Balthasar came to, that history consists of the mutual intensification of the yes and the no to Christ. Our job is to say yes in such a way that is convincing and appealing and persuasive.
Well, I think one of the best ways to do that, Gil Bailey, is not only to say yes to Christ and to emphasize that yes, intensify that yes, but also intensify our no against the alternative. Because yeah, as Joe Racinello loves to say on the show, how's that working out for you? Go look out the window. Go turn on the TV. Doesn't look very good. This is your whole book, and just even the, just the title of your book, the Apocalypse of the Sovereign Self. Just go look at what's going on in the street. And I think you could see what Joe and I would describe, and we have to leave it here, Gil. What Joe and I would describe, if you look at civilization, particularly Western civilization, from the fall of the Roman Empire to Luther's revolt, okay, that in our point, that's the enlightened part of history, not what came afterwards and what the secularists and the atheists want to call the Enlightenment. No. That's the real Dark Ages, because what it tried to do was decouple Western civilization from its Christian moorings. And I think you could demonstrate that. And you're going to be a real historical, you know, argument for that, because guess what? Ever since 1517, Western Civ has been on a downward trajectory. And you know, and again, so we have to intensify our no. And what Joe and I like to say on the show all the time is the answer is no, because our answer to Christ is yes. Gil Bailey, go ahead. Finish. You got about 30 seconds, Gil.
Our no is in service to the yes. Our no is always in service to the yes.
Absolutely. Gil, where can folks buy the book?
Well, Amazon, of course, but Angelico Press, Barnes & Noble, wherever books are sold.
Absolutely. Gil Bailey, the book is The Apocalypse of the Sovereign Self, Recovering the Christian Mystery of Personhood. Please go out and buy the book. Gil, thank you so much for a lively conversation. Needless to say, you are welcome back at the front, Joe. Front line with Joe and Joe anytime, our brother.
Thank you so much. God bless you both.
God bless you. And thank you all out there for joining us at the Veritas Catholic Radio Network, 1350 on your AM dial, 103.9 on your FM dial, spreading the truth of the Catholic faith to the New York City metropolitan area. Download the app, share it with your friends. You'll have access to all of our station's content. And if you like what Joe and I do, we're all over social media, Rumble, YouTube, Facebook, Twitter. Like, subscribe, share. Help us out. Do all that fun stuff. And remember, until the next time, that our conversation is your conversation, and that conversation is going on everywhere. We'll talk to you soon.